This is the Francine Show on 84 WHAS. She's got a couple of days off. I'm Paul Harris, proud to be taking your place and sitting behind the microphones here on 84 WHAS. She will be back on Friday to do the radio want ads, put some more people back to work, and then, of course, she'll be here for Thunder this weekend and all next week as well. And as Derby time approaches, she gets more and more excited. I'm guessing the few days that she has off this week are because she needs a hat or nine. It takes her a while to find the appropriate Derby hat. Last year, I celebrated 30 years in the radio business, which sounds impressive until you compare it to the record of my next guest, who in September will celebrate 40 years in show business, almost all of them standing alone on a stage talking into a microphone, as one of this country's top touring comedians, who for a long time was Frank Sinatra's opening act, who now does a one-man show, and is also the subject of a new book. His name is Tom Dreesen, and the book is about the years that he spent at the beginning of his career in America's first and possibly last black-and-white comedy team. He was the white guy. The black guy was Tim Reed, best known as Venus Flytrap from TV's WKRP in Cincinnati. Tom, I'm a fan, and I'm happy to have you on the show today.
Thanks, Paul. I just realized I didn't know that. I was the white guy in that act? No one ever told me that.
Well, you know what's funny? In reading the book, there were times when many people said to both you and Tim, you're not black enough.
Yeah. I know. You know, the times, you know, you figure we went on stage the first time in 1969, and when you think back, for those who can, you know, I mean, there were riots all across the land. Cities were burning down with riots, and in Detroit, in Chicago, in New York, in Los Angeles, in Compton, and the Vietnam War was raging. Students were protesting all over America. And Tim and I said, "This would be a good time to become a comedy team." You know? So it was the times and the stress and we paid dues like no other act paid. That's what the book is about, Tim and Tom and American Comedy in Black and White. Good. And it's been getting great reviews, and now there's people talking about a movie offers, you know, about wanting to make it a movie. Just that period piece from 69 to 75, what it was like.
Who's going to play you?
Well, Jeremy Piven wants to play me, and there's another kid named, do you know Ryan Flippy is the kid?
Yes.
Who was Reese Witherspoon's husband?
Yep.
But he's starred in a movie recently, Flags of Our Fathers, and he read the book, and he came up to me in a restaurant. I was having dinner with Clint Eastwood, and we were sitting at Nantana's, a restaurant that Clint likes to go to, this kid came up to me, and meanwhile, waitresses are tripping over each other. They're dumping trays, and, you know, girls in the restaurant are walking into the wall, staring at this good-looking kid. He came up to me and he said, "I read your book, and I want to play you." And I said, "I was a lot better-looking than you when I was your age." And I was only kidding, of course. But he frowned, and I said, "Hey, I'm only kidding." But we'll see. We'll see what happens, what kind of offers they make.
What good-looking kid is going to play Tim?
You know, I don't know. There's a lot of people out there. I would love to see like a Will Smith kind of guy, you know, because he's got the comedic chops already, you know.
Yeah. You guys started as a comedy team by going out and doing presentations for the Junior Chamber of Commerce. That was really the beginning, wasn't it?
Well, we were in the JCs. That's how we met. You know, I had just gotten out of the service, and Tim had just graduated college, and so he lived in Norfolk, Virginia, but he was recruited out of Norfolk State College by E.I. DuPont into Chicago as a marketing rep, and he joined the JCs, and in a little suburb on the south side, Harvey, Illinois, where I'm from, and I had written a drug education program teaching grade school children the ills of drug abuse with humor. It was a concept I had, you know, and I never thought any ever in my life of going into show business. It was the furthest thing from my mind. And Tim worked with me on a project, and it became very successful. JC's used it as a model program in their publications in 50 states and in 22 foreign countries. And it was very successful. And one day a little eighth grade girl said, "You guys are so funny. You ought to become a comedy team." And the thought of a black-white comedy team intrigued us. So we started it. And, you know, we went out and did like everybody else. We wrote what we thought was funny. And we went on stage and bombed. And we asked the owner, could we come back the next night and bomb again, and he said, sure, come on back. And that night we did good, and we started getting better at it, and then we started paying dues. There were no comedy clubs in those days. There was one in New York called The Improvisation, but it didn't pay. So we had to go out. He had a wife and two kids, and I had a wife and three kids. And we had to go out and make this thing work. So we worked hard and paid dues that no other act ever had to pay. We worked all black clubs in the North and the South, what they affectionately called the Chitlin Circuit, black-owned, black-operated nightclubs, like the 20 Grand in Detroit, the Sugar Shack in Boston, the High Chaparral in Chicago, the Club Harlem in Atlantic City. And we worked all white clubs in the North and the South. We ended up working the Playboy Circuit for years. You know, we became a very viable comedy team, and got very good at what we did. But the times, it was very, very difficult. You know, on the fourth time on stage, a guy put a lit cigarette out in Tim's face. A guy tried to beat me half to death. It was a strange thing going on in America in those days. But we survived, and we're still the best of friends, and the book is all about that.
Who'd you have more trouble with, white audiences or black audiences?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about racism, if there was a black guy who hated white people in those days, hated white people with a passion, he wasn't mad at me. He was mad at Tim for being with me. If there was a white guy who was a redneck and hated black people, he wasn't mad at Tim. He's mad at me for being with Tim. You know, and so that element, for the most part, people really liked what we did. You know, 96%, 97%. But the element that didn't made life miserable for us, you know.
Yeah. It only takes 2 or 3% to stand up and start heckling you.
Yeah. But we handled it. We became very professional at it. And we handled it. But there was always that danger element in certain towns at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. We'd finish a gig and be hungry and want to go get something to eat. And there's stories about that in the book that will fascinate people, as well as there's real funny stories. I mean, the book will have you, all the reviews say things like, I laughed and then I cried, and then I laughed and then I cried. And that's what the book is about.
There's one story about an encounter you guys had in a diner, and I can't remember where it was, but it made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And then at the end, I said, did you guys really do that? You know the one I'm talking about where you went off in a hail of gravel?
Absolutely. It was called Jim's Cafe. And see, my problem was I boxed when I was in the service, and I grew up on the streets. You know, I have a lot of street fights. Nothing I'm proud of, but that's just the way where I was raised. You know, I'm Irish Italian. I had one of those tempers that when somebody calls you out or calls you names, that you want to stand up to them. But in most of the times where we were, that if you had to bite your lip, because if you could see the danger element was there, and also I would endanger my partner too. You know, with my hot temper. So this particular time, when they, you know, we went into this redneck cafe at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they went to work on me, you know, because I was with Tim. So they went to work on me, and they read, you know, a little name calling here and there, and you have to read the book, but I got him in the end, I had to do it very carefully.
Yeah, and you're also glad that the car worked.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I had Tim back the car up to the door. When I got to the door, I told him what I thought of him, and I slowly stepped out the door and bolted in the car.
Go drive! The book is called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. The Tom is Tom Dreesen. You can find him online at tomdreesen.com. 61 degrees now in Louisville. I'm Paul Harris, talking with comedian Tom Dreesen. He's been one of America's top touring comedians for 40 years now, since he started his career as half of a black and white comedy team, Tim Reed being the other half of that. The story of that and more about their lives is in a terrific book they wrote with Ron Rappaport called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. It is a tremendous read about anybody who wants to know inside stories from showbiz, and particularly inside stories of a part of show business you may not be aware of, which is the difficulty of being a black and white comedy team a year after the assassination of Martin Luther King, at a time when our country was undergoing all sorts of changes. Your act in those days, Tom, was not exclusively about race, but race played a big part of what you were talking about on stage, right?
Well, yeah, and we did routines about one being black and one being white. We did some routines about that. We did a lot of routines that weren't racial, but the mere fact that we were on stage was racial. It's interesting that in the last election that Senator McCain and President Barack Obama were calling out for more discourse among the races. I would burst out laughing every time I heard it. We need more discourse among the races. 40 years ago, Tim Reed and I were that discourse. You know, we'd be on stage. The mere fact that a black guy and a white guy were on stage, even if we weren't talking about race, we were the discourse America wasn't having, you know. We were a black guy and a white guy on stage having a lot of fun because we were friends and doing our routines. You know, we captured the audience immediately when we went on stage because they'd be saying, oh, what's this going to be about, you know. So we were that discourse. I thought the book should be called Before Our Time. The publishers overruled me and called it Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. But everybody who ever reads the book said, wow, you guys are way before your time.
You mentioned earlier that occasionally hecklers would get up and they'd have a problem with one or the other of you based on race. But what about club owners? Was it tough getting a black and white comedy act booked?
Sure, there were people who were you got to remember, integration. The Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964. This was only 5 years removed from the Civil Rights Act. So when you'd go in clubs, you'd rarely find. You might find a couple of black folks in it in all the white clubs. If we went into all black clubs, you rarely find any white folks in there. So it was still somewhat segregated at that time, you know, even though they could feel comfortable. I mean, they could go into those clubs. They didn't feel comfortable doing such a thing. So here we were, representing that. And the interesting thing about that is there's a hypocrisy among liberals, among white liberals, that I find all the time, that while they claim that this is what they advocate this, they don't necessarily support it. And Tim and I were rejected all over in an industry that was supposed to be tolerant of that. And we fought for every gain we made. We fought for every inch, of it,
How important were the Playboy clubs to you?
Very important, because Hugh Hefner gave us the opportunity to do. We were doing 5-6 shows a night. Playboy clubs, you got to remember, were all over the nation, in Boston, in Chicago, in Cincinnati, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, in Baltimore, Kansas City. And these clubs would allow you the opportunity. We'd do 3, 4, 5, some in Cincinnati, 6 shows a night. They had 2 showrooms, the Penthouse and the Playroom, and we'd go from one to the other, and that our timing became incredible. After a while, we became a very viable act because of the Playboy clubs.
They were almost an oasis for you, weren't they?
No question about it. Yeah, no question about it. It was very, very good for us.
There's a great story in the book about some of the tension, several stories about the tension that developed between the two of you, not necessarily over the content of the act, but about the lack of progress the act was having in moving up the ladder of show business. And in one night in particular, it made the act better having all that tension blow up backstage, didn't it?
Well, yeah, Tim is a little more impatient than me, and I'm a motivational speaker. I give, aside from being a stand-up comedian, I give motivation speeches for corporate America and at universities. It's a passion of mine. I've read literally hundreds of books on the powers of the mind. So I'm always very optimistic. It's going to work. It's going to be fine, Tim was a little bit more impatient, and there were times, you always have creative, comedy teams have creative differences all the time, but our problems were never racial at all. We both accepted one another. We were comfortable in our own skin. But one night we had a creative blow-up in a club called Mr. Kelly's in Chicago. And it was a big club and a big break. And we were arguing back and forth on this issue, arguing when a woman said, 2 minutes, you guys, and Tim, we were so angry, Tim threw a glass and it hit the wall. And we were so angry at one another. Now we had to go downstairs. We weren't even looking at one another. And we couldn't even look. And they introduced us. We went on stage and had maybe the finest performance of our career. But what it was that energy. That energy we had. When we hit that stage, we hit our punchlines. And it was just incredible. We just killed the audience. And afterward, we were both like exhausted. Tim said, maybe we should have an argument every night before we go on stage,
20 years ago, Tom Dreesen released a comedy album called That White Boy's Crazy, which was recorded in front of an all-black audience in his hometown of Harvey, Illinois. That was 20 years after the time that you and Tim had set foot on stage. How different was it to do it in front of an all-black audience then, as opposed to 20 years earlier on the Chitlin' Circuit?
Well, I grew up in that area, so they all knew me. I mean, I played basketball on all-black basketball team. I played football on all-black football team. I mean, I was known in the community, you know. And so, you know, Richard Pryor had an album, you know, called That N-Word's Crazy, and he tried to take it. He said, you should have your album called That Honky's Crazy. I said, well, you know, I would do that, but no black person ever called me honky. My whole childhood, all they ever said to call me was white boy. Hey, white boy was at that game. Come here, white boy. Tell them what happened. You know, here, come here, white boy. He was at the game. Tell me. I mean, it was always. I was 13 years old when I found out my name wasn't white boy. You know. So that was. So I went in and did the album in my home audience. You know, and it's still. I mean, you can still. The album sells all over. As you said earlier, you can go to TomDreesen.com. DREESEN. You know, DREESEN. People spell it wrong all the time. You can go there and find out all the information about that.
Tim couldn't join us today, but Tom is here talking about the act and other things in his life, one of which I think probably up there in importance has got to be the Chicago Cubs, because I hear you went to a funeral for the Cubs or some sort of cremation for the Cubs last weekend. Is that right?
Yeah, we cremated the curse in Chicago. We went into Chicago and into a parlor. Hundreds of Chicago Cub fans wearing all their Cub memorabilia and everything. And we each, there were like nine speakers who got up, and all the curses the Chicago Cubs have had in the 160 something years that they've been in existence, we cremated them. We put them all in the coffin, and then all of us pallbearers carried it outside, and we took it in a crematorium, and we cremated all the curses. So the Cubs have no more excuses. They're gone. This is the year.
I don't want to hear about the Billy Goat anymore.
No, I don't want to hear about the black cat, the billy goat, all that stuff. And because we cremated him, and one of the reporters said to me, well, did it work? I said, well, we'll find out in October if it worked. <You know?
laughs> let's talk a little bit about your relationship with David Letterman. You were just on the show a couple of weeks ago. You were on there a couple of months ago with Tim talking about the book. When did you and Letterman first meet?
We've been buddies ever since he came out here to California with an old red pickup truck. And we started out at the Comedy Store together, and we became instant friends. Maybe because we're both from the Midwest, I don't know. But we played basketball together, and we played racquetball together, and we've been friends ever since. And when he doesn't feel good, he lets me host the show. So I always say to him when I see him, you're not looking so good. You should take some time off.
You did fill in when he was sick a couple of years ago.
Yeah, he's a good buddy, and I've done his show, I don't know how, maybe 70 times. He's been very good to me through the years. He's been a good friend.
And Jay Leno was also starting out right around the same time. Was he part of that same group?
Yeah, Jay and I met in Boston outside the Boston Playboy Club when Tim Reed and I were a comedy team, and we've been friends ever since. And you know, and I've done 60 something Tonight shows. You know, 50 with Johnny and about 11 with Jay. But I do David almost exclusively now. Although Jay put us on when the book came out.
Which was very nice. Were you ever offered your own late night show?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, all the years I toured with Frank Sinatra, the 14 years I toured with Frank, and 45, 50 cities a year, I was having the time of my life. First of all, I also play golf on a tour called the Celebrity Players Tour. I'm a founder of the tour. It's basketball, baseball, football, hockey, tennis, and show business people that are 10 handicap or below. So it's a lot of, it's 42 Hall of Famers, and in show business, it's, you know, I was the only stand-up comedian on a tour at one time. So I was doing that, you know, and then I was also flying in Frank's jet all over the world with Frank. So I was offered more sitcoms than most comedians get offered in a lifetime. And I kept turning them down because Christopher Morley, the author, once said, success is living the life you want. You know, I used to shine shoes in a bar and all my childhood, and Frank Sinatra was on the jukebox singing Come Fly With Me, and here I was flying all over the world with him. And then I used to carry two bags a day caddying, and now people were paying me to play golf. I just didn't want that to end, you know.
You were having too much fun to do TV.
I know. I still do. I still, once in a while, an offer will come down. You know, I think it's just, I'm a stand-up comedian, first, last, and always. That's what I love to do. I love writing jokes and then going to tell them. And so I think that that's what you should spend your life, doing what it is you love to do, you know.
You mentioned golf. How about that choke yesterday by Kenny Perry at the Masters?
I know Kenny. I'm the master ceremonies of the Bob Hope Classic every year, and I'm the master ceremonies for the AT&T Pebble Beach for Clint Eastwood and for the Frank Sinatra tournament. So I do a lot of golf, and I know Kenny, and I know him to be just a wonderful human being. But I don't know that he choked so much as it's just that's a tough game. It's a tough game. He played as good as he can, and Angel just shot through, you know.
Yeah. Kenny's from Franklin, Kentucky, so a lot of people here know him as well. I got to say, he was classy in defeat, saying great players make plays when they need to, and he just didn't.
You know, we learn more about people in defeat than we do in victory.
Yep.
You know, and the character, the true character of a human being comes out in defeat. And Kenny showed yesterday, Kentucky should be very, very proud of him, and I'm sure they are.
You talk in the book a little bit about your years with Tim, and then later on as a solo comedian, opening up for musical acts. Of course, all those years for Sinatra, and before that you did a few years with Sammy Davis Jr. But at the beginning, especially when you would go out and do rock concerts, they didn't want to see a comedian out there, did they?
No, you know, Tim and I once opened for Shannon and I when Shannon and I was a biker group, you know, before they became television watered down. Biker, they were throwing beer cans on the stage. those are tough times, you know. And we were both married and had to make the money, you know. We had to, the guy told us, you know, you're doing 17 minutes, and I don't mean 16 minutes, and I don't mean 18 minutes. 17, I want you off. Oh, you don't get paid, you know. So we had to, you know, we went out to booze and hisses and beer cans being thrown at us. And but, it, you know, through the years, those are great training grounds for you, you know. If you can learn to endure, you know, and stick it out. Because show business is a tough life, but if you love it and you believe in it, you'll survive. Bertrand Russell once said, there are people in show business who become major stars simply because they didn't have sense enough to quit when they should have.
Yeah.
Well, that's my story.
Yeah, maybe that applies, absolutely. There's a wonderful story in here about you and Sinatra out at dinner one night when a woman comes up and, almost ignoring you, says to Frank, I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you go out there night after night in front of all those people. And Sinatra said something to her that was much more a compliment to you. He turned it into a line about you. Do you remember the one I'm talking about?
Yeah, we were in Florida doing a, it was the governor of Florida's wife. We were in Florida doing two big shows in an arena, and in between shows we were having dinner backstage with all these dignitaries. And the woman said to the governor's wife, she said, I don't know how you do it every night, Frank. And I was at the very end of the table. And she said, you walk in and sing in front of me. He said, he has the toughest job in show business. And they pointed at the table, and everybody looked at me. He said, the stand-up comedian is the toughest job in show business. And he was right, you know. He is right because, the singer has the orchestra, the lights, the sound. I mean, they have certain things that they really need to help support them. The comedian is out there all alone. It's like walking a tightrope every single night. You're out there alone and relying only on your timing, your vocabulary, your inflection, and you know, you realize with your vocabulary and the inflection on a word, you cause this sound to come out of people's bodies that fills the room like electricity and unites everybody. It's laughter, you know, and it's a pure art form.
Plus, as you point out in the book, the people in the audience didn't come to see you.
That's right.
To see him.
And those particular cases, you know, in most cases, they come to see the comedian. But when you work with a Frank Sinatra, I don't care if you're Barbara Streisand, they didn't come to see you. You know, they came to see Frank, you know.
Tell me a little bit about Sammy Davis Jr. I wish that I had started going to Vegas in the years when he was still performing there, and I had been able to see him in person, because here was a truly unique performer.
Extraordinary, extraordinary, extraordinary is all I can say about live performing. You know, there's a lot of difference between an actor and a live performer. You know, actors hide behind the fourth wall, which they should. You know, the live performer tears the fourth wall down and looks at and works with the audience. No one could do it better than Sammy Davis Jr. He truly was an extraordinary performer who overcame insurmountable odds with a lot of help from Frank Sinatra earlier in his career. But when you saw him perform, you saw what he could do. He could do it all. He could sing as good as anybody out there. Frank said, I never heard Sammy hit a clinker. You know, Frank would hit a clinker once in a while. Sammy would never hit one. He could dance better than anybody out there. He could do comedy as good as any comedian. He could do impressions better than anybody out there. He could play the piano, the drums. He could play the trumpet. I mean, there was nothing he couldn't do on a stage.
How did you go from being a half of this comedy team to being a guy who's out on the road as a solo act opening for Sammy Davis Jr.?
When he saw me, after the team broke up, I struggled for a while, and after my first Tonight Show, my whole career just boomed up. First Tonight Show appearance in those days could launch your career, and it did mine. CBS signed me to a development deal. I was doing Dinah Shore, Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, Johnny Carson, rock concert, Soul Train, American Bandstand, Midnight Special. I mean, I was doing all these shows, and then there was one show called Sammy and Company that Sammy hosted, and I wanted to do that show. And I did his show, and he saw me, and he took me on the road with him. He promised he'd take me on the road, and he did. He took me all over the world. He took me to Vegas for my first time, you know. But to night after night, I would sit in the wings and watch this man walk the stage and perform the stage. It was like going to school every night, you know.
Yeah, what a performer.
He was amazing. In the book, it's too long to tell here, in the book there's a story about the greatest single performance I had ever seen and something he overcame. And it's in the book. It's a great story about how good Sammy Davis was and what he did.
It is a terrific story. The book is called Tim and Tom, an American Comedy in Black and White. I want to wrap this up kind of where we started by talking about you and Tim Reid being America's first, and as I said, probably last, black and white comedy team. Has there been another one? And if not, why not?
Well, I would say you would have to ask people in our industry, but there has never been another one because of the dues we paid. And I believe it's the hypocrisy in the show business industry that they, you know, and I'm going to cause a lot of controversy here. But again, I go back to, you know, white liberals run our business. And by the way, I'm not against them. I'm just saying while they claim to advocate all this, they don't really get behind it. Tim and I, we were America's first black and white comedy. If Tim Reid would have written this book by himself, he would have gone a lot further, or if Tom Dreesen would have written it by himself. It's something about Tim. When we broke up, Tim went as far as he could, and he was very successful, and so did I, and I was very successful. But somehow they didn't want us to be successful together. And I say this, after the book came out, we were separated for 30-something years and still friends. So we got together again, collaborated this effort, and we went out and we did this book. Well, David Letterman put us on because we called David Letterman. Jay Leno put us on because we called Jay Leno. Craig Ferguson put us on, and Bonnie Hunt because we called him. Tavis Smiley because we went direct. The rest of the industry began to ignore us. The L.A. Times, a white liberal newspaper, refused to review us. The New York Times, white liberal newspaper, refused to review us. Larry King wouldn't put us on. The View wouldn't put us on. Oprah Winfrey wouldn't put us on. And yet, all these are things they all advocate. You know, my point is something about us being together. You know, and I'll rest my case with this. If Barack Obama would have been married to a white woman, he had never gotten the nomination of his party.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why, but it's something about that we represent that there's something they fear or something, you know. So that's my, you know, I'm sure your listeners now, you'll get all kinds of calls in and say, I dispute that or I agree with that, you know.
But here's what you need to do. Add Paul Harris to the list of people to put you on. I would have loved to have Tim on, but his schedule didn't permit it, so I'm glad I had a chance to talk about it with you, Tom.
But he will come on. He will come on, and you could ask him that same question. He said, he emailed me that he's doing something this morning, but he would love to do your show.
That'd be terrific. I'd love to have him on sometime. Let me get the plugs in here for Tim and Tom, an American comedy in black and white. That's the book that Tim and Tom wrote with Ron Rappaport. It is not just about their years as America's first black and white comedy team, but also about their subsequent successes in the business through the past several decades. Tom Dreesen is now touring with his one-man show called Shining Shoes to Sinatra, and performing at events all over the country, and is also online at his website, tomdreesen.com. Look for him on The Letterman Show fairly often, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk again sometime. I appreciate your time today, Tom.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for everything.